Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, March 20th, 2025, we're delighted to host a discussion on unleashing American energy at CEQ. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no positions on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we'll keep our introductions of our guests today quite brief, certainly more brief than their distinguished careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Garrett Krall. Garrett is an associate at DLA Piper's Washington, D.C. office, where he practices administrative and environmental law. During the first Trump administration, Garrett worked at the Environmental Protection Agency as a special advisor. And I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Krall, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kayla, for the introduction, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting today's event. Before I introduce our two distinguished panelists for today's discussion, I want to go ahead and make a couple of points up front first, and that is to echo, Kayla, use the question and answer function, and please do insert questions into the chat feature. We're going to endeavor to get to all of those at the end of our discussion today. And the second is that this webinar is being recorded, so you're going to be able to find it as well as a library of similarly valuable discussions on the Society's website, as well as on the Apple Podcast Store for free download. So I recommend those to all interested. Before I introduce our panelists, I wanted to give a shout out to the audience. Thank you for attending. And thank you to Mario and Ted for offering your expert opinion on CEQ and NEPA. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce Ted and Mario, and then we can turn it over to each for their opening remarks, maybe 5 to 10 minutes of opening remarks, and then we'll go ahead and facilitate a discussion. So Ted Bowling. Ted is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Perkins Coie. Over the course of his career, Ted has worked at the U.S. Department of the Interior, U.S. Department of Justice, and most relevant to this conversation, and most recently, at the White House Council on Environmental Quality as Associate Director for NEPA. Next, we have Mario Loyola. Mario is a professor at Florida International University and a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. During the first Trump administration, Mario served as the Associate Director for Regulatory Reform at CEQ. So our panelists did work together at CEQ. There was some overlap there. So hopefully that will make for an interesting discussion today. There's a lot of ways to talk about and open up this next chapter of NEPA CEQ's story. There's been so many disparate actions going on. You had the amendments to NEPA in the Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2023, Marinato Bond decision paired with Iowa VCEQ, unleashing American energy, the recent Trump executive order after which this panel was named, which directed CEQ to propose rescinding the NEPA regulations and publishing guidance on NEPA. The comment period on CEQ's proposed rule closes in a week from now, and the final rule and the interim final rule's effective date is April 11th. So there's just a lot happening in this space, and this is the beginning of this next chapter here. I'm hoping that Ted and Mario can help us explore what this all means for the regulated community and for those affected. So Ted, I'll pass it over to you now.
All right. Thank you, Garrett. And yes, it's a real pleasure to be talking with you all again, and particularly being paired up with Mario Loyola for another of our series of conversations, which started in 2017 or thereabouts, when Mario joined us at the Council on Environmental Quality. We worked together through the development of the 2020 NEPA regulations, which are back in fashion, back in force and effect by virtue of the summary judgment ruling in Iowa versus the Council on Environmental Quality. But that's really sort of a limited time opportunity, as Garrett noted. We have by virtue of Executive Order 14514, CEQ has issued an interim final rule, which has an effective date of April 11th to eliminate the CEQ regulations from the Code of Federal Regulations. And that will effectively take us back to 1977. In the first 7 years of NEPA's existence, CEQ only had guidance out to agencies, and agencies had a largely a choose-your-own-adventure approach to NEPA, with a great deal of variation on NEPA approaches. And really, the Carter executive order was attempting to bring a higher level of order to agency procedures, for CEQ to codify what had been an evolving series of cases, as well as also evolving agency experience. And in January 1st, 1970, President Nixon signed NEPA as the first of many environmental statutes, and really sort of, the start of what became known as an environmental decade. With all the legislation that followed it, NEPA was intended to serve as one process to help guide and agencies as they evaluated the significant environmental effects of federal agency actions, and for CEQ to lead in the study of those environmental effects and guide agencies as they were considering alternatives and mitigation. We've come a long way since then, but in 2020, we were charged by the president with setting out new rules of the road, better procedures for more efficiently evaluating environmental effects of agency actions, threshold considerations. Does NEPA even apply to a particular agency action? You'd be amazed at the number of times that agencies would sort of start down a NEPA course and then before asking, well, wait a second, why are we doing this? As well as also making sure that they looked at the threshold determinations of, is there an applicable categorical exclusion, and really leaning in on using sort of the minimum tool necessary for environmental analysis, leaning in on lead agency leadership in the NEPA process, and I'm expecting that what we've got now, if effective April 11th, is a restart on the work that was left for the agencies starting in the summer of 2020, and really with the effective date of September 14th, 2020, the Trump administration and the first Trump administration was setting a course towards a comprehensive update amongst all the agencies of their NEPA procedures. The current state of play is as it was in September of 2020, where all the agency NEPA procedures cue to the 1978 CEQ regulations. They haven't been updated. And so that's really the task at hand. And I'll invite Mario to jump in here on as we start our dialogue about this. But I think, what CEQ is attempting to do is, step out of the way. It's their they're not one-stop shopping for NEPA procedures at this point, but leading a process of updating all of the agency NEPA procedures, which are, you know, available to you online at NEPA.gov. That's the durable CEQ website. I got panicked a little bit this morning because it was down, apparently for maintenance, but NEPA.gov is your one-stop shopping for all of your NEPA guidance and also all the agency NEPA procedures. And you look at that and the 87 sets of NEPA procedures out there, you have a sense of the sort of the Herculean task that's ahead, where within 1 year, you know, all of these agency NEPA procedures will be updated to reflect the Fiscal Responsibility Act amendments to NEPA, which codified some of the 2020 CEQ regulations, as well as just, you know, adapting the NEPA process better to their current agency authorities. You know, some of those agency NEPA procedures actually predated the CEQ procedures. Most of them dated to, you know, the 1980s. There had been updates. I mean, certainly, I mean, during the Bush administration, we did a fairly comprehensive update of the Department of the Interior NEPA procedures, but that has a crosswalk to the CEQ procedures, and the CEQ procedures they crosswalk to are all from the 1978 procedures. So that hasn't been updated. There's a lot of just basic housekeeping on the environmental impact assessment process to be done. That work has basically been due and owing since September 14th of 2020. So that's sort of, you know, setting the groundwork there. I want to invite Mario to jump in on sort of his thoughts on the way forward, and we can start a dialogue there.
Well, and this is a good example of the kind of productive discussion that we had over several years at the White House about all of this. I want to disagree sharply with something that Ted Bowling said. Again, a very typical disagreement of the kind that we had during those years. He described the task ahead as Herculean. I think the task ahead is certainly Homeric. I don't know if it is Herculean. I think it's beyond Herculean. Why do I say that? Because I think that the basic monster that we're facing here is one that would have exceeded even Hercules' capacity, which is the hydra-headed nature of the federal bureaucracy and the fact that you have a federal bureaucracy here that presents project applicants with not just one government and one federal decision, which is what we had aspired to in the first Trump administration, but a hydra-headed process that makes little sense to most project applicants who are put in the position of having to stitch together what amounts to an ad hoc interagency coordination process amongst a bunch of people who often do not feel any particular obligation to call them back, and often don't call them back. And this is after spending millions of dollars on a project application for some necessary, often vitally necessary, major infrastructure project in which there is not just a national interest, but a vital public interest in the agency taking effective action. And because of the hydra-headed process, the agencies are not able to fulfill the public interest in effective, timely agency action. I think that we don't have to argue that in the abstract. By international standards, I think it's fair to say that and the data on this are you know, all, sort of all over the place and hard to come by. But just anecdotally, it seems fairly clear that the U.S. has the most costly, most time-consuming, and riskiest, most unpredictable system of permitting and environmental review in the world or close to it, and that the gold standard is really Australia, Denmark, countries like that, where you have, particularly in the case of Denmark, a one-stop shop where infrastructure deployment is integrated much more with regional planning, and the siting is sort of decided even before you know know who the project proponent is going to be, and it's just a different system that is worthy of study and that I hope Congress and the administration will spend time looking at. But I think that the problems here that we're trying to address, that we've tried to address across administrations of both parties, are really at the end of the day tinkering at the margins of a problem that inheres in the Hydra-headed nature of the federal bureaucracy and the dispersion of permitting authorities among all of these different agencies, and cannot be fixed. The problems that we're trying to fix cannot be fixed until you fix that. With that said, one of the things that we are looking at now, you know, in the wake of the interim final rule that CEQ published and the guidance that it's published to agencies, is what is the role of CEQ in coordinating agency NEPA procedures? And I think that the CEQ interim final order could have distinguished more sharply between two different aspects of CEQ's interaction with federal agencies in the implementation of NEPA. The interim final order refers to CEQ's authority to issue binding regulations, but of course the key question in Marin Audubon Society, in the Iowa, Idaho case, and maybe potentially in Seven County Infrastructure about to be decided by the Supreme Court, is whether CEQ has the authority to issue regulations that are legally binding and create legal obligations for agencies that are judicially enforceable. That is different than the question of whether CEQ can create rules of internal agency procedure under the Administrative Procedure Act. Those are still regulations. Whether it can create regulations that are binding on agency heads as a matter of the president's inherent Article II authority to administer and manage the executive branch. And here we're thinking of Executive Order 12866, which established the process for regulatory review, or rather amended the Reagan-era process for regulatory review, what we now call the 12866 process. That's an executive order. It's certainly binding on agencies, because if agency heads don't follow it, they risk being removed by the president. Like I like to tell my students in administrative law, there's a hidden phrase at the end of every executive order that reads, "or you will be fired," right? And that is the hook. Otherwise, an executive order would be totally precatory. This is why Humphrey's executor matters and the removal power matters. And so binding on agency heads as a matter of Article II executive authority is different than binding on agency heads for purposes of judicial enforcement of what CEQ says. And here it is clearly one and not the other. Because why? Because NEPA contains no delegation of rulemaking authority to CEQ. And so it was a and so I think that there was some slight, the 1970s were a different decade, and the judges felt much freer to sort of make up law based on what they thought congressional intent was, and the precise wording of the statute didn't really matter that much. And so writing at that time, CEQ back in 1978 used what we might consider today some sleight of hand to talk about the regulation as if it was going to be judicially enforceable. It is not CEQ's intention that these regulations be enforced by courts before a final agency decision. Phrases like that appear in the original CEQ regulation. And I would say that this was an unfortunate little smoke and mirror show, because the CEQ regulation should never have been judicially enforceable. They should have been the fact that they're adopted through a notice and comment rulemaking under the Administrative Procedure Act does not in and of itself make a rule of agency interpretation into a judicially enforceable, legally binding regulation. The federal courts have been very clear about that. DC Circuit has been clear about that. And so where are we now? So and why is that bad? So why is that bad? Because it expanded the litigation footprint of NEPA. And the reason why agencies spend so much time and such an inordinate amount of resources, $15 million on average for the preparation of an EIS just in agency resources, on average, is fear of litigation risk. They don't want to be overturned, and there's a million different reasons why an EIS could be vacated. And so litigation risk is what's driving this inordinate commitment of resources of time and resources and unpredictability on the part of the agencies. And so where does that leave us? Well, I think that the best position from the point of view of permitting reform is to say that CEQ definitely has authority to issue regulations or guidance that is binding on agency heads, and they should expect to be very prescriptive about that, and even prescriptive to an even greater level of detail than the 1978 CEQ regulation was. Why is that? Because we should have uniformity. We should have one federal decision. We should have as much of a one-stop shop permitting process as possible. And because there's a lot of, you know, evidence of, you know, capture by various pressure groups of age or influence, if you like. And I think that is part of what's missing in federal NEPA practice is due regard for the national interest in effective agency action and effective agency implementation of the policies that the president was elected And so to make sure that those policies are given voice and effect, it is very important that agencies, that the White House and CEQ be able to control to a high degree of precision how the agencies are implementing NEPA. And my prediction and my hope is that the executive order on unleashing American energy now requires, as the next step, that CEQ lead a series of sort of an interagency working group to review agency procedures. I think it will emerge in the course of this iterative process that agencies cannot be left to their own devices to do NEPA their own way. That this entire process has to be sort of guided according to rules of procedure that are determined ultimately by CEQ in the final analysis. I will say that why does this matter? Because among other things, there's a lot of unanswered questions now, and we don't want agencies coming up with different answers to them, because there's these questions on NEPA implementation that we're facing now should have uniform national answers. For example, the sort of unanswered questions left that we still have to contend with that were left behind by the Fiscal Responsibility Act's amendments to NEPA. For example, what impacts must be studied under NEPA? The Fiscal Responsibility Act talked about reasonably foreseeable impacts. That's really just a codification of what a lot of courts had said. Agencies still need guidance on what impacts must be studied. Are we studying impacts outside the jurisdiction of the agency? For example, what constitutes a major federal action? Now, the way that the Fiscal Responsibility Act defined a major federal action under Section 110(10A), the term major federal action means an action that the agency carrying out such action determines is subject to substantial federal control and responsibility. This language has perplexed a lot of people. I think that it's a fairly obvious drafting error, and I think why is that? Because by definition, every agency action is subject to substantial federal control and responsibility, because the agency action is the agency part of the project, right?
Mario, can I interrupt you there? There's a lot there. Ted, would you like to respond to some of that? There's
mediation,
there's the multifaceted nature of NEPA analysis and agencies.
Let me just start off by, first of all, I appreciate Mario's rich analogy to the labors of Hercules. I think it's a little inept. I would not refer to a hydra-headed bureaucracy, nor is serial decapitation the appropriate approach, because we're talking about agency professionals that actually need to make good judgments and to get the job done. I would say that of the labors of Hercules, we ought to have an analogy to the Augean stables. And, we need to redirect resources to clean out the Augean stables as Hercules redirected rivers. The filth of the Augean stables in this case is sort of confusion, mistrust, and I would agree with Mario, fear of litigation. I mean, the number of times that we had situations come to us at the Council on Environmental Quality, where I spent, half my federal career after, roughly 10 years at the Department of Justice and 5 years in the Solicitor's Office, trying to encourage agencies, just make a decision, we're going to defend it. The chances of getting enjoined are low if you go through the process well, you respond to substantive comments, make your judgments, make it clear the facts found, the conclusions drawn, the basis and your authority to do that. I mean, the arbitrary and capricious standard works out about as you expect it would be. Most agencies win their NEPA lawsuits. The challenge is to make your decisions efficiently and move through litigation efficiently so that it does not become a drag on the state, the system. I'd agree with Mario on drafting errors in the Fiscal Responsibility Act amendments to NEPA. I mean, it codified many aspects of the 2020 regulations, but it missed a number of things. I mean, Congress is very focused on deadlines and endpoints. 1 year for an EIS or 1 year for an EA, 2 years for an EIS, but they're completely ambiguous as to the starting point, and so consequently, the current state of play is agencies sort of, feeling like they've got to have an entire draft EIS more or less written before they can actually declare the start of that 2-year EIS process. That reflects a lack of codification of what I think are the most important aspects of what we did in the 2020 regulations. The creation of a system of senior agency officials, strong lead agency, issue resolution, maintaining milestones. I mean, that's the guts of how do you actually get through, particularly an applicant-led NEPA process, is through leadership on how do you make the process work. I tend to agree with Mario that we ought to have a strong Council on Environmental Quality that's has the capacity to lead this effort, and also do issue resolution. We shouldn't be relying on vague admonitions. There ought to be very specific direction from CEQ as to how the process should work. And, I was a creature of the executive branch for 30 years. I mean, I believe in executive authority and the president's ability to, by virtue of executive order, take care that the laws are faithfully executed, including that NEPA is faithfully executed, and do that by directing organization. It's just my concern at this point is that the CEQ guidance that's been issued is largely a series of talking points with some ambiguous references to how the agencies should consider voluntarily relying on the 2020 regulations in completing ongoing NEPA reviews or defending against challenges to reviews completed while those regulations were in effect. And I just don't see how you actually get there based on this. I think we really do need, and you know, you need CEQ doing more than just sort of like monthly meetings of a contact group on the update of regulations. So to, you know, CEQ needs to be staffed appropriately. The agencies need to be staffed appropriately to do the reg revisions. And having been involved in a reg writing exercise that started on January 10th, 2020, and completed in July of 2020. I know that this can be done within the time frame given of 1 year. I'm more concerned about it being done well and being done in a coordinated fashion. So, Garrett, have you got some questions for us? You want to just for us to do point counterpoint as we go forward?
Sure, I've got questions. We have one or two in the chat also. But Mario, would you want to respond to anything that Ted said there before I pose a question?
I think Ted and I have, you know, as usual, have iterated our way to a lot of agreement on this stuff. I mean, I think we've you know, the time limits, the page limits.
What about the page limits? I mean, are those meaningful? Can you just design something to be below the page limit, but essentially get all the facts in the appendix? I mean,
Ted may remember what my point always was on page limits is that if everything's in the appendix, then your 200 page limit becomes effectively a page limit on the executive summary, right? So and then you still are dealing with a 3,000 word appendix. And so I think it's very important for Congress to look at this and say, you know, that the legal sufficiency of the document has to be determined on the basis of what's within the page limits and without reference to anything that's in the appendix. The appendix can be there to support what's in the document, but you know, I think one idea, for example, is to limit the exorbitant resources that the agencies are spending on this. Why not just limit the amount of money that agencies can spend on an EIS to $500,000?
And you said it was 15 million? Was that your estimate?
Yeah, 15 million, 14.5 million, I think, was the average.
If I could ask, what's the source of that number?
My intuition that 500,000 is a better use of taxpayer resources than 15 million.
Okay.
I'll tell you what the source is. The source is that, like, the biggest report that a think tank in Washington, D.C. ever produces costs maybe $100,000 to produce. That report should be a report of that scope, 100 pages, should be more than enough, which is enough to guide, you know, the federal government in its like autonomous vehicle transportation policy for the next decade. That should be more than enough to guide an agency in its decision on a permit involving a single solar project, right? Yeah. I mean, at some point you have to attack the inordinate, outrageous expenditure, waste of taxpayer resources on a process that does not, that goes far beyond what's necessary to inform the decision maker.
Well, I would say, you know, funding is a very rough measure there and highly debatable. I mean, we had, you know, the Department of the Interior had posted on the front of every EIS how much went into that EIS, but we could never really do the accounting exercise there. And you had the funding, how do you distinguish the NEPA funding from the Endangered Species Act, Section 7 consultation, a 106 consultation, and the Historic Preservation Act? But I would like to rise to the defense of page limits and perhaps preview where the Chief Justice was going during the oral argument of the Seven County case, where he latched on to those page limits as well. That's some basis of limiting agency analysis. And, you know, Ed Kneedler quickly responded, "Well, we have appendices," and you know, there's a little bit of a chortling about, "Don't try that here in the Supreme Court." You know, I think it's valuable to have 150 pages as your target, up to 300 pages, because that within those pages should be everything you need to know about what's significant about this project. What is your range of decision making, reasonable alternatives? You know, what's the context here? And frankly, you shouldn't ask a senior agency official to be reading a whole lot more. And I've been a co-conspirator in this regard. I mean, I remember the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan with that. It was like, 1,200 pages or actually more. I calculated that if I were to read it cover to cover, it would take me 21 8-hour days. Senior agency officials don't have that amount of time to devote to just one decision. And so having that essential information, what, the members of Congress really wanted when they enacted NEPA was in one concise location, tell us what's significant, tell us how do we minimize and how do we mitigate it. It's not an unreasonable ask. It's just, it kind of goes back to that adage of I would have written you a shorter letter if I had more time. It does take effort. It takes a skill set, both writing and analysis. And frankly, the mechanism of appendices, I don't care. You can have as much in the appendix you want, hyperlink to it all. But it's just, if you need to know more, go to the appendix. But everything you need to know is right here in 150 to 300 pages.
Yeah, and let me add another important point that I think is salient given not just the looming decisions on NEPA, but also Loper-Bright and the overturning of Chevron deference, which is I think that CEQ has another very important role here. A CEQ regulation has another very important role here that we haven't discussed, which is as persuasive authority on what NEPA means, right? And what does major federal action mean? Especially what does major federal action mean after the Fiscal Responsibility Act amendment to major federal action, right? Yeah. What do these statutory terms mean? Obviously, we're not going to get controlling deference under Chevron. It wouldn't have been appropriate to give them controlling deference under Chevron, since Chevron itself was predicated on a delegation of rulemaking authority to the agencies. And then what do the courts do about gap filling, where Congress didn't specify the meaning of a particular term, but always within the context of delegated rulemaking authority? Remember that about Chevron. So therefore, arguably, Chevron never should have applied to the CEQ regulation. But leaving that to aside, now we know that it doesn't apply because Chevron got overturned. So where are we? We're in Loper-Bright. And what does Loper-Bright say about agency interpretations of statute? That they're due Skidmore deference. What is Skidmore deference? Skidmore deference is the deference that they're due because of the persuasiveness of what's contained within the four corners. And so for CEQ to see, that's why I think that CEQ guidance should have a section guiding agencies in interpreting the Fiscal Responsibility Act's amendments of NEPA and providing further clarity on what does a major federal action mean? When does the clock start ticking on the time limits? What does fall within the page limits? What meaning do we give categorical exclusions, right? Which are another issue that we'll have time to discuss here before the hour's up.
Yeah. Well, we do have some very good questions here.
Sure. Yeah, I'll go ahead and read you guys the first question. The first question states, how do we achieve a one-stop shop for permitting with multiple agencies having a different expertise and large projects often requiring permits from these multiple agencies? So would designating a lead agency for a project address some of the issues we've been talking about, or would it be more practical to have a central permitting office that would be responsible for gathering all requisite information and analysis from different agencies?
Yeah, I'll invite Mario to weigh in on the central permitting office idea, because that is the model in some countries. But we have a more let a thousand flowers bloom approach. Every agency is responsible for its own NEPA office. But we also have in the current NEPA procedures that construct of a lead agency, the one with the primary interest there, and then cooperating agencies. And I routinely get the question about, well, do we need a better system for resolving who's the lead agency? I'd say, no, that generally resolves itself. And we've already got the CEQ, authority or written in regulations to help agencies decide that. I do think that there is a need for greater oversight on, the big, the significant projects. And the permitting council created by Title 41 of the FAST Act is my best hope for more active leadership in that regard. It's been in sort of proof of concept mode for quite some time. Our colleague Alex Hergott led it during the Trump administration, and with some success. But there's still this crying need for active handholding and really the application of expertise on how do we keep the small stuff small, how do we move forward on big projects and get big things done. If you read the book How Big Things Get Done, you'll see that part of getting big things done is really effective planning processes. Planning processes that are well run. So Mario, what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's a great, these several questions that we have here are great. I hope we get to all of them. I will say that yes, on this one, you're right. It's all of the above, right? Because, I think that the model that we can follow in the United States and build on is when you think about how Section 7 consultation operates, every project that has to undergo Section 7 consultation doesn't need an Endangered Species Act permit, but it has to go through Section 7 consultation in order to minimize, mitigate, avoid impacts to species and so forth. And I think that is the right model to separate the permitting aspect from the regulatory and enforcement aspect and say, it could be the permitting council as a one-stop-shop agency, some future permitting council, or it could be the lead agency, as the questioner suggests, can grant the permit that is necessary to begin construction and start operation, right? One permit that covers that. And then in order to get that permit, you do a round of consultation with the other action agencies that have jurisdiction to do a kind of consultation to come up with a set of conditions that will achieve minimize, mitigate, avoid environmental consequences. This seems to me a more rational system because right now the agencies don't really even have much capacity to coordinate amongst each other. In these multi-permit situations, and you find a lot of a lot of very important projects just die on the vine because of a catch-22 that one agency saying no, you have to get the other agency to give you X, and then the other agency says, well, before I give you X, you have to get that agency to give you Y, and you can spend millions of dollars and years in this loop going round and round in circles, and it's clearly something that we need to fix.
Yeah. I would say that the answer to that, and my default answer, if you will, or my philosophy is transparency. And particularly, for the past 4 years, I've been counseling clients who are trying to get to the notice of intent, trying to get to the start of the NEPA process, and wishing that agencies would have on sort of a dashboard, if you will, all of their pending applications. And you say, okay, you don't have enough information for this application to move forward through the NEPA process. Well, be explicit. What are you waiting for? Why do you think you need it? Because oftentimes we're struggling with that, sort of the insatiable appetite for more information that can be sometimes separated from what do you actually need for purposes of your decision making. And that's where agency guidance, agency leadership is needed. You can't just decentralize everything and have like a GS-12, relatively new person making sophisticated judgments. They need, training, they need oversight. And frankly, these decisions are too important to allow, projects to languish based on uncertainty and problems of interagency coordination.
All right, next question here. We've got, it's about the interim final rule, and it's wondering if it's defensible. Do you guys anticipate any litigation there? As I mentioned earlier, the comment period for the interim final rule closes in a week from today. The effective date is the 11th. of April. What are you guys seeing as next steps there?
I think litigation risk is 100%. But here's the very straightforward defense of the interim final order. If it is true, well, first of all, the CEQ, you know, NEPA has no delegation of rulemaking authority for CEQ. Right? The only source for the CEQ regulation was the Carter era executive orders that required CEQ to issue a regulation. Therefore, the Unleashing American Energy Executive Order 14454, whatever it is, rescinded that Carter era executive order. And by rescinding that Carter era executive order in, you know, the body of administrative law, it has rescinded the authority that the CEQ regulation was based upon. Remember, this is all just internal operations of the executive branch, because none of this stuff should be judicially enforceable, right? And so does the CEQ, was the agency following the CEQ regulation? That's only a matter between the agency head and the president. That doesn't involve anybody else. And so it shouldn't have involved anybody else. And so therefore, if you add all of that up, it must be the case that what remains of the CEQ regulation should be rescinded by an interim final order. And it's even possible to argue that not even the interim final rule was necessary, because just the executive action by itself that rescinded the Carter era order also rescinded the CEQ regulation. So the answer is litigation risk 100%, but I think there just is no textual basis in the statute for sustaining the CEQ regulation as enforceable. Well, the danger is otherwise, which is, and here's what CEQ really has to think about, which is that the courts will just say, well, we've already incorporated all of this cumulative impacts and all this other nonsense into our common law. And so they're just going to go on enforcing the CEQ regulation because now it's been incorporated into their common law. And this is part of now, and this is the difficult issue of how do we interpret, the analogy to the Loper-Bright donut hole for Chevron. You know, look, we're reversing Chevron, but not with respect to all of the prior decisions that were based on Chevron. So are we reversing the CEQ regulation? The courts will ask, but what do we do with the prior decisions enforcing the CEQ regulation, which are now common law? Are those also going to be disturbed? That's a very difficult question. I don't have an answer to. Maybe Ted does.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me just say I agree with the comment in the questions there that I think the Supreme Court and the Little Sisters of the Poor case is more or less explained that, well, you can go with an IFR and then basically, cure all your ills by responding to comments that you receive on it. And, I think the litigation risk is perhaps high because it's sort of a target, but the chances of prevailing on the merits are probably pretty low. And let me just clarify, as I should have at the outset, I'm not speaking on behalf of any particular client there. This is just my own personal take on it. But to Maria's larger point about, so what is the effect of this rescission of the CEQ regulations? I think it is rampant confusion as to what is the applicable law, and that CEQ's guidance has not really addressed that. And that we're going to go through a period of significant uncertainty. And as mentioned, cumulative effects is a great example. Is there like, do we have to do cumulative effects analysis? Well, of course you do, because that's just an aspect of effects. If you have direct or indirect effects, those effects can be accumulate with other things, and cumulative effects are just context. And the Supreme Court made that very clear before the CEQ regulations in the Kleppe decision in 1976. It was building on a body of case law. It goes back at least to Hanley v. Kleindienst in the Second Circuit. So, cumulative effects are not going to go away just because the CEQ regulations go away. What you need is some approach to how do we actually do the bounding analysis on effects analysis. The Supreme Court might, and maybe Justice Thomas is going to write a second chapter to the public citizen case for us in Seven County and help clarify what do we mean by reasonably foreseeable effects and how does that effects analysis intersect with, the limits of agency authority.
Yeah, I think
that could be quite useful.
Yeah, I think great segue to what I think is the next question, Garrett.
Yeah, please go ahead. I'm Mario. I know you wrote something on Seven Counties, so talk about that or the next question, whatever you got.
So the next question is when Justice Thomas writes the Seven Counties decision to simply restate public citizens holding in slightly clearer terms, how do you think that will affect NEPA review? So I think what is at stake in Seven Counties, what's at stake in what impacts need to be studied, what alternatives need to be studied, what cumulative impacts means, and what the role of what's at stake in all of that is whether NEPA requires agencies to go beyond their narrow jurisdiction and expertise in their consideration of environmental consequences, right? So then how far downstream from the agency? Seven Counties is the perfect thing. It's the Surface Transportation Railway Safety Board, which is Surface Transportation Board, which is issuing a railway safety permit, a certification of railway
public
convenience and necessity, but its expertise is, it doesn't do rate regulation anymore, right? Which was what it was originally created to do. So now it's just looking at, the risks of operating a railway. And, importantly, nobody at STB knows anything about climate change or climate policy or anything astrophysics or anything else like that, right? And so, we have in the Seven Counties case, and I hope the Supreme Court really focuses on this, a DC circuit that gave no deference to the agencies or very little deference to the agency on the stuff that's actually within its jurisdiction and expertise, which the Administrative Procedure Act instructs the courts to defer to agencies on, right? Unless it's arbitrary and capricious. And then turns around and requires and vacates an EIS because it didn't go into all this stuff that's totally outside the agency's expertise. And which, if it had mentioned and had based a decision on this study of climate impacts, could have been challenged on arbitrary and capricious grounds for considering factors that Congress didn't intend the agencies to consider. This is all in State Farm, right? And so this is a very important decision. NEPA has been searching for a limiting principle on what downstream impacts and upstream impacts need to be studied. And I would submit Paul Clement tried to articulate a rule that said reasonably foreseeable. Justice Thomas, unfortunately, was not super happy with that articulation. And as he asked the respondent when it was the respondent's turn to see if he could give a shot at Seven Counties' articulation of the rule, I think that the limiting principle is not in NEPA. The limiting principle is in the Administrative Procedure Act, right? The limiting principle is to be found in the framework of deference, which relies on agency jurisdiction and expertise and instructs courts to pay no attention to agencies that are talking about stuff outside of their jurisdiction and expertise, right? That is where the limiting principle should lie. And that's why I think that there is a role for CEQ. Cumulative impacts, cumulative impacts means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. If it means that when you're taking account of the affected environment, you have to take account of dynamic trends in the affected environment because it's not like a snapshot in time. Yeah, okay, you have to take that. That's part of affected environment analysis. If it becomes a warrant for, you have to take into account that this is also, there's all these other impacts of other actions and all these natural processes going on, and you have to think about all that stuff, underlying planetary cooling trends and warming trends that the agency doesn't know anything about and isn't supposed to be taking into account in its permit decisions, then no, right? Then I think that what the courts will need to do to resolve the question of limiting principle is to you know, really continue to revive the scheme of the very sensible scheme of deference and non-deference that's in the Administrative Procedure Act, Section 7.
So should CEQ get deference? We've got another question here on that. Any special deference to CEQ, being that it's a smaller, you know, it's a council, 100 or so staff and some prior administrations, a lot of detailees. Does CEQ get deference?
I think it's due the under Skidmore deference. You are due the deference that you deserve, right, and that you have earned within the four corners of whatever you said. So yes.
Yeah, I think Mario is essentially right that CEQ received substantial deference in Sierra Club v. Andrus, case that predated Chevron, based on the logic of the NEPA procedures that it promulgated. And that's why they were, the 1978 regulations were in place for as long as they were. And they frankly, they needed an update, not a fundamental overhaul. Ultimately, I really think that Ed Kneedler had the best line of attack on what the D.C. Circuit did in the Seven County case, and that was they were fly-specking it. It was, very smart judges looking back at, the way the downstream analysis was done, the upstream analysis, and, the effects on oil and, the exploitation of waxy crude resources, that there was the entire purpose behind the railway. And they said, oh, yeah, we can see how you could have done more here. And that shouldn't be allowed. I mean, that's not consistent with the APA standard. And when Paul Clement was asking for a new standard, and both Justice Jackson and Justice Kavanaugh were asking skeptically, do we really need a new standard here? I think what they were getting at is, there's real force and effect of having a clearer articulation by the Supreme Court of how deference to agency expertise should occur. And in this case, it's particularly important to recognize that NEPA is an interagency consultation statute. I disagree with Mario on the view that, well, STB should limit its expertise to, what it knows well, which, frankly, they didn't get any deference on the risk of a train derailment, which is something the STB knows very well. And the concomitant risk of fire or water pollution from a train spill. I mean, they should have received deference on that. But then also on, the greenhouse gas effects. I mean, that's why the statute provides for interagency coordination, to receive the views of expert agencies. And you're not expected to know everything about everything. You don't have to have astrophysicists on staff, if that's necessary.
Quick response to that. I mean, I think that elections have consequences, and if a president wants the agency to study greenhouse gases or the impact on, Native American basket weaving or whatever, right? The agencies, that's a matter of presidential administration, and the agencies, elections have consequences. Agencies have to do what the president orders them to do. The question is whether NEPA creates a judicially enforceable requirement that the agency study greenhouse gas impacts, which is, that's what was at issue in Seven County. And the answer to that clearly has to be no, right? And so the question is, what's the right how do we draw the line so that agencies know in advance with some certainty that they won't have to study this stuff?
I would say, yes, indeed, elections have consequences, but facts are stubborn things too. And this is primarily a science-based exercise, or at least it should be. Chapter 5 of the first annual report issued by the Nixon administration talked about the issue of the effects, man's effects on the climate. So that's a well-known issue. What's really at hand is, okay, the bounding analysis. How do you go about evaluating, and what cases do you evaluate? Because, I'm producing greenhouse gases as I'm speaking right now. is it worthwhile for me to evaluate the effects of my, you know, production of CO2? No, I'd submit not. What sort of projects is it worth looking at, you know, the greenhouse gas effects? That's something where, you know, frankly, that should fall solely within CEQ's wheelhouse. You look at their duties under Title II of NEPA, they ought to be the authority. And frankly, I understand there's some latitude for, you know, presidential direction on here's how we're going to approach this. It directly applies to the Unleashing Energy Executive Order. I mean, it's, you know, a presidential priority towards energy policy, and that should be expressed through the analysis done in support of energy projects.
Well, we've come to the top of the hour here, so we're going to have to wrap things up. But thank you, Ted and Mario, for your expertise on what is sure to be an interesting time for NEPA and CEQ. And thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this webinar. Please do look forward to future events. Kayla, would you like to take us out?
Absolutely. I'll first echo those thanks. Thank you so much to our panel for joining and participating. We really appreciate you taking this section of your afternoons and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other coming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.